What's up, peers? And I welcome you to join the WasabiCast, a Bitcoin privacy podcast. Today, I sit down with the one and only Shane Radcliffe from Liberty Under Attack Publications and the VANU podcast. VANU stands for Voluntary, Not Vulnerable. It is a liberation strategy for sovereign individuals to increase their freedom today in the here and now, and to increase their mean time to harassment, which is the great metric of how free you actually are, like how long since last someone stole from you, either, of course, a private individual or the biggest attacker, the state. And this lifestyle is very compelling with a very wide-ranging bouquet of nuanced strategies, from as extreme as wilderness VANU and camping outside in the woods, far away from any potential attacker, to things like van nomadism or digital nomadism in general, and all the way down to having a homestead, a citadel, to grow your own beef and to raise your cattle and, well, to live a free life. Also, part of VANU is privacy itself, right? To selectively reveal yourself to the world. Because, well, if the attacker does not know who you are and what you do and how you communicate, well, he will not attack you. And this is a rather efficient way to increase your mean time to harassment by being more selective with how you reveal yourself to the world. Pierce, this really was a fantastic conversation that I enjoy quite a lot because, well, I've learned quite a bit from Shane over the last couple of years, specifically in the VANU podcast. So we very much encourage you to check this one out. And on somewhat of a technical note here up front, before we actually get into the show, is that we have upgraded. Join the WasabiCast is now on the podcasting 2.0 ecosystem, meaning specifically that we are experimenting with some cutting edge Bitcoin and podcasting technology. And that is especially that we have hooked up our RSS feed to a Bitcoin Lightning Network node. Meaning that if you are actually in favor and if you receive some value out of all these countless conversations that we're having here, you can toss us some sats automatically in a podcasting 2.0 enabled podcatcher per minute or even boosting some content that you like. I would very much encourage you to check it out just, well, for the fun of it, because it's really cool technology. So get a capable podcatcher like the Breeze Lightning Network wallet or the Sphinx chat application, where, by the way, we also have a Join the WasabiCast tribe for some chatter amongst the peers listening. This is a grand experiment and only the beginning of it. We will do some more interesting, more interactive formats for this podcast in the near future, or after some back-end magic has been set up. But Pierce, without any further ado, let's get actually into this conversation about all things VANU, on how to live voluntary, not vulnerable, and how to increase our mean time to harassment. Thank you very much for listening. So Shane, very happy to have you here today for this conversation. How's it going? How's it at Pasnia?
Hey, yeah, things are good. Things are good. For folks who listened to the VANU podcast and caught our last conversation, I'm working on food self-sufficiency here at the Free Republic of Pasnia, as I'm calling it. And, yeah, it's going well. I guess since the last month or so, we've talked. The ducks are about twice as big, not more. And, yeah, I just got another 5 lambs, this past weekend. And, we'll be getting a few new goats as well over the next week or two. So, yeah, the objective is to double the crew each year of lambs. And, we achieved that, this past weekend.
Does that scale? Yep,
exactly. No, it only scales to a certain point. When you have 22 acres, there's only so much doubling. But yeah, we just recently in the past couple of months, we ran, there's basically two fields, on either side of the driveway, and we've got electric fences running down the whole side of the west side of the driveway, and then on the east side of the driveway. Yeah, that one's not fenced off yet, but yeah, next year or two I'm visualizing a field full of lambs. So that's what we're working on over here, as well as obviously more of the second realm sort of intentional community foundational stuff. So yeah, things are good. It's progressing. Just taking our time and enjoying it. And yeah, I guess that's pretty much it right now.
Oh, fantastic. I mean, it seems like you're pretty far down the Bitcoin or freedom and self-liberation rabbit hole. But let's go back a couple of years. Like, what do you think kind of kickstarted your role down this journey, and what motivates you?
Yeah. So I actually started Libertarian Attack Radio, which is now defunct. It's Libertarian Attack Publications. We publish actually a second round book on strategy and some other agorists and crypto anarchy sort of books. But I started LUA Radio back in February of 2015, and it was very much at that time. Was not into the self-liberation stuff, wasn't what I would call an anarchist, had never even heard of the term Bannuin. Obviously hadn't come across Second Realm stuff yet. I was, I guess you could say, more of a minarchist constitutionalist here, in the States. And I guess more in kind of the conspiratorial realm, dug through a lot of Bill Cooper, the now late Bill Cooper's material, for anyone who might be familiar with that. So that's actually where I started. It was way back there, back in 2014, 2015. And very soon after I started LUA Radio, I came across some anarchists, and I guess anarchy wasn't what I'd been told it was, as is the case for most everything. And it went down the deep dive of Austrian economics, read the Rothbard, the Mises, got through Human Action, which I'm still pretty proud of, got through kind of the economic stuff, went through some of the philosophy, and I got to a point, being in alternative media. There were a lot of podcasts, a lot of libertarian podcasts and radio shows and all that, but there really was a major lacking of solutions. Like, okay, obviously free markets are good. Like, that's the preferable way, right? Like, no coercion. Obviously the state is the biggest inflictor of that coercion. So why don't we just kind of, let's be free now? Like, what are we going to do about it? And there wasn't really a whole lot of talk about it beyond agorism. Obviously Bitcoin was around at that time, but it still wasn't as big as it obviously wasn't, as where it is today. So I saw an opening and really just took it. And we did what I call the Direct Action series. We did that over on LUA Radio back in 2016. And from then I came across Vanu, which is we can definitely get into more. But I came across Vanu and Rayo and this this really hidden portion of libertarian history, and a very, very practical and forward looking, very, very Ray of the founder of Bonu, actually. Now we know that for sure. He was a very forward thinking individual, and back in the 1960s was writing about, as we've talked about in conversations over at the Bonu podcast, Max, he was very much a cypherpunk. He, obviously utilized a pseudonym, was talking about, encrypted, encrypted ham radio networks, that would serve as, commerce back in the day. So like, he was a very forward looking individual, and, that kind of opened my eyes to a lot of things, these radical lifestyle changes that Bonu kind of relies upon, and came across Second Realm at some point. And I love that. I love that because there's a lot of organizing the digital realm, like with Bitcoin, for example, and that's fantastic. But, especially after last year, when a lot of things started breaking down in the physical world, and, access to food and other things necessary for survival became difficult. So the most important thing now, at least what I'm focusing on, is actually organizing in physical space and time. And that's where I saw so much value in the Second Realm book on strategy is, obviously there are digital pockets of freedom that provide freedom, but physical space and time is important too. So that's kind of the long and short of it is I randomly, I just stumbled across things in my path, and some of them seemed to make a lot of sense and seem practical. And here I am, the Free Republic of Paznia, and I guess just kind of making a go at putting together the Second Realm Network here in so-called USSA. So, that's pretty much it. Pretty much it.
Nice. Very nice layout of all this conversation that we can have now. Many rabbit holes to go down to. First string that I would like to pull is actually Liberty Under Attack Radio. Like, this kind of seemed to be like your forte, your first step into this entire ecosystem. But I mean, why? Like, why did you decide to kind of speak up and to share this knowledge that you were gathering?
Yeah. I guess really I guess I kind of went over it very quickly, but Bill Cooper was a major foundational part where I am today. Essentially, like I said, I went through a lot of his material. I went through all 2,000 plus hours that are archived. I think they're still archived on his website, hourofthetime.com. But I went through all those archives, listened to his, you know, 9 hour, all his presentations that are on Fascist Tube. You know, I dug through all that material and, you know, it all really resonated with me at the time. And, you know, I saw it, you know, really valuable, his focus on the Constitution. He was, you know, he was actually doing things, you know, organizing militias there in Arizona. And that was really important to me at the time. And, I guess, there was, one part of, in one of his presentations, I think he was saying, he didn't care if people disagreed with him. And he obviously is for, you know, freedom of speech. And one thing he said was, you know, if you got something to say, start a radio show. And that was like very, very impactful to me at the time. And I, just kind of, decided, you know, Bill died in 2001. And at that time, I didn't see a replacement. Like I wasn't familiar with, I guess, the so-called replacement for Bill on the radio. And that's what I wanted to do. But that very, very quickly changed. So that was my original motivation was, the original path was just that, you know, I didn't see anyone that was, you know, filling the gap of truth that he was. And I thought I was going to be that person, and everything worked out very, very differently. I guess not necessarily differently, but, it didn't end up, where I thought it would for sure. But yeah, that was pretty much it. And obviously there was a passion for freedom, for what I thought freedom was at the time, which certainly that's evolved.
What was your view of freedom at that time?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, like I said, I was an anarchist constitutionalist, so my view on freedom was basically, I guess, the very confused view of freedom. I think at that time I was even pro-police, which is strange, thinking about. But yeah, I mean, it was really just kind of the minarchist, you know, limited government constitutional position. Like it was just that generic kind of starting point where a lot of people get stuck at. But yeah, I wasn't there for very long, but it was, and then it evolved with Bill, and it got back to kind of, more of the, you know, I guess the actual, I guess, so-called original interpretation of the Constitution and militias and those sorts of things. Kind of a lot of that constitutional militia type stuff. That was where I was at that time. That was where it was.
Uh-huh, interesting. And what type of format was that radio, actually? Was it just you blabbering and doing presentations, as Bill often did? Or was it more a guest type of interview?
So the first few months, I guess it was more so, we had a couple guests, but it was a 2 hour live radio show. Sometimes I had guests, sometimes it was me and a co-host. I had many co-hosts over the few years on LUA, but, yeah, a lot of time, initially it was more so just me and co-hosts. And then after that, especially like the direct action series, it was always interviews. So, pretty much it evolved into an interview only format. Pretty quickly, I would say.
Mm-hmm. And why interviews? Why do you think that that's a meaningful type of conversation to share?
Yeah. So, I mean, especially for the direct action series, you know, these were, especially back in 2016, still now, there's a lot of these strategies and, you know, lifestyle changes that I haven't tried out myself. So the value of having a guest is that these people had all been doing these things for, you know, few years or 5 years or 15 years or 20 years. They had a lot of experience. They had a lot of resources, a lot of knowledge. So that was it. It kind of naturally evolved into that because it would have been, there's only so much that I was familiar with when I started, I guess, when we did the direct action series. I was like 22 or 23 at the time. I really didn't have a lot of life experience to draw upon there. So it was, it was pretty much primarily the interviews where a lot of that value came from. Really, really incredible guests, that, you know, were doing a lot of incredible things back then, and a lot of them still are. So yeah, that'd be the major benefit. I mean, that's where I got a lot of knowledge out of it. Got a lot of, I mean, it expanded my worldview a lot. Yeah, a lot of these things, they don't talk about these strategies, you know, in your thousands of hours of, you know, indoctrination in government, you know, government schools. They don't talk about these things. So, and that's kind of been, something I've really honed in on in the past year or so is, you know, gotta expand that view. You gotta keep, it's hard to find where, I guess, where the, it's hard to figure out where the propaganda and brainwashing ended. So, anyway, that's basically it. Just a lot of value from guests, a lot of value from guests for sure.
So, and yeah, for sure. Like, I think it's also a great excuse of being a podcaster or radio show host. To kind of get interesting people to talk to, because
yes,
kind of everyone likes to be publicized and to be well talked about. And for you as the host, it's a great way to actually talk to people and to ask questions without kind of having this weird feeling of interrogating someone because it's publicly announced.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes. And beyond that too, I mean, that's an important thing too, the networking. Being able to have these conversations, you know, reaching out to, pretty large people, I guess, pretty popular people. I wouldn't be, there'd be no reason for us to have a conversation before, right? So yeah, you're exactly right. It definitely provides a very good excuse, for, you know, starting conversations with people. And it's a good opportunity. It's open up the conversation for the public. So, that's another thing. But, you know, going back to the Free Republic of Pasnia too. I mean, the radio show was the foundation for everything I'm doing now too. So I found out about through LUA Radio, something called the Midwest Peace Liberty Fest in Michigan. In 2015, through a colleague I met on the internet, who started a little, I guess, organization, Liberate RVA, down in Richmond, Virginia, Cal Molina. He told me about this Freedom Festival that's taking place, and I just ended up showing up there. And now, I've got here at Pasnia, we incorporate, you know, security culture principles. Only people who I know or who have been vetted can come out here. Well, my first layer of trust, essentially, the first people that came out here for Bonnie Fest 1, were essentially like, you know, the 20 or 25 people I've been going to Freedom Festivals with, especially then the Midwest Peace and Liberty Fest for the past 5 years or so. So, as far as that's a pretty significant thing too, is the podcasting. Not only did it just provide, you know, good, you know, online networking skills, like, I'm the editor for Agoras Nexus now. So I get paid Bitcoin to, edit articles over there. So that's pretty neat. That wouldn't happen without the podcast and all that. So, I mean, yeah, obviously the online stuff is great, but it's manifesting into physical space and time. Like, we're actually building something here. We're building something here, and it's pretty incredible. And it all started with, very, very, you know, not lack of a plan, lack of a vision. I was just doing what I thought, doing what I was passionate about, freedom, and was just going to see where it led. And yeah, that's here we are.
Mm-hmm. And right, this freedom and this kind of spontaneity can be very, disruptive at points, right? And you can almost radically change your course of action. And you said that this happened to you, right? That you eventually moved on from this radio type. Kind of what led you to that change?
Yeah. So I guess, I wrote my book. I guess I finished my book, mid 2018 or so. Strategy for Self-Liberation. And, I suppose that was about the time I was wrapping up LUA Radio. I mean, I'd already been doing the Vonnie podcast, and most everything we talked about on LUA, could have been worked into Vonnie. So I didn't see a point in continuing both of them. And LUA Publications kind of naturally, naturally started out of that. And, I guess it was right around that time. Like changes in the air or something. I had just started a new job as an electrician apprentice. And I was, gonna do that. You know, it's good paying, best paying job I ever had was, you know, trade. And, it wasn't a bad job. I enjoyed it. You know, there's, you know, lots of learning, lots of opportunity. But after about 6 months or so, like, I just stopped going in. Like, I wasn't feeling it anymore. I made a decision to move to Austin, Texas, move in with my co-host to the Vonnie podcast at that time, Kyler Reardon. And, made a quick random, I guess, move to Austin, Texas. Never been to Austin before. Just kind of randomly felt like I was called to do it. I guess that's the best way that I can explain it, you know, looking back on it. But I ended up in Austin, was there for a couple few months, and, they were renting an apartment, and the lease was coming up, near the end. The lease was coming up, and I had a pretty quick change in living situation that I had to make. And it just so happened that, my buddy Jason Henza was coming down, from Chicago to, driving down to Acapulco, Mexico. And, he said, you know, I can come right by there, pick you up. We'll go to Acapulco, and, you can come stay out there as long as you want to with me. And I was like, so I made another crazy move. Never been to Acapulco, before either. Obviously never driven through there. Been to Mexico a couple times, like tourist spots for, you know, vacations, but never road trip through Mexico. So, I hopped in the car with him and we road tripped Acapulco. I stayed there from, November to December, 2018, was it? 2018. Yeah. It's years all run together now, really. But yeah, it was at end of 2018, stayed there, until Christmas, and then came back to, I was going to come back for the holidays to see my family, and, never got back to Mexico. But, I ended up coming back to, the homestead where I am now. Had no plans to start what I'm start what I have going on here now. But it was just like with, I guess within the span of maybe like 6 months, it was a pretty nomadic adventure. A lot of spontaneity. No real plan or vision. We're just kind of going with it and seeing where things ended up. And like I said, I ended up back here at the homestead. And by that time, some folks in my network had started this travel job. And they'd stop by the property every once in a while, and it kind of naturally coalesced into a spot for some of my nomadic people to stop by and camp and all that. And yeah, last year that's the worldwide nonsense kickoff. And I got a little panicked. I eat only meat essentially. And when there were fears of meat running out at the grocery store, which I was dependent upon then, which is not a good thing, which is why I'm doing what I'm doing now. But yeah, that fear kind of hit me, and I went and got some lambs and some goats, and here we are today. So it certainly wasn't a smooth, well-planned, well-executed, plan by any means. But I think this is kind of the way that it had to happen. It's the way that it did happen. But I don't know. It wasn't easy, and still figuring things out. I've never done anything with like farming or livestock or anything like that. So I'm just learning everything as I'm going, and it's hopefully it pans out. It's going well so far. So that's kind of what I'm banking on to continue.
Yeah, it's quite incredible how adaptive humans can be, right? And how we can fit even in stressful, ever-changing situations and somehow make the best of it, right? So what do you think were some of the upsides as well as the downsides of that kind of erratic, nomadic lifestyle?
Yeah. So I guess the worst thing was that I was basically wholly dependent. I could travel. But I didn't have, a good network of like online jobs to keep me afloat at that time. So like it was very, very, very sketchy financially. So that was kind of one kind of downside. The unknown, which the unknown is also a positive too, in my opinion. So it kind of goes either way. But really the positive, and this was, I guess this was the part to my entire decompression process from the Serval Society. And I noticed this myself, but with people, when you're in a, 9-to-5 job, 40 hours a week forever, and you're always within that Serval Society mindset, go, 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 survive, survive, survive. You don't really have a whole lot of time to think about anything else, right? So, that was kind of the first opportunity I had. Because I was either working and or going to higher level indoctrination college. Before that. So there wasn't a whole lot of time to really think about anything, to reflect on my life growing up and all of that. So, that was really the first time where I call, and this is what Rayo called it too back in the 1960s, but, I live what I call now a liberated lifestyle, where my time is my own. I decide my schedule. I decide what I do. And that started, essentially, like it really fully started, I would say last year. But that was kind of the first opportunity I had for a multiple month span. To really start going through that. So yeah, that was a major upside that even though, it was, tumultuous, even though it was, very dicey at times, my time was my own still. And there was a lot of value in that. There was a lot of, even through kind of the chaos, there was that, kind of that kind of calm, that the freedom was, I could kind of feel that little hint of freedom. Yeah, it was certainly the catalyst for a lot of things to come, and I'm trying to think of any other upsides or downsides that come to mind, but not really. I mean, that was the biggest upside, and the other one, which is just kind of obvious if you're in a position like I was, that's just kind of you're going to deal with, money might be tight, but at the same time, like there's other benefits too. So.
Yeah, like to the financial aspect, right? For one, if you're constantly on the move, like a meat space occupation is probably going to be tricky. I mean, there are not that many physical occupations where you can be that flexible with where you are in meat space. well, of course, when working in cyberspace on, you know, whichever project, that allows you a lot more meat space flexibility. So yeah, I would guess that nomads who really do have this digital income, hopefully in Bitcoin, right? That kind of solves, or at least, you know, helps with that first problem.
Oh yeah, it's huge. It's definitely huge, and it's why, like, over at the Bonnie podcast, the first thing we talked about in season two, like when we got to, you know, the action, was financial independence. Because that's time, really, that time is important. It's really important. And then just there's also the fact when we're talking about Bonnie and vulnerability to coercion. You know, the servile society 9-to-5 employment makes one very vulnerable to coercion. And a lot of time there's, you rely upon one source of income, and that's not a good thing. That's not a wise thing to do, as we kind of figured out, over the past year. For those of us who didn't already know that, you know, relying upon one single source of income was unwise. Now people know. So yeah, no, you're exactly right. The internet, a lot of these opportunities, you know, these online opportunities, Bitcoin, it's huge. Definitely huge. Yeah, so much so there was a project, there's an now defunct project that I was working on called Darklands, which was supposed to be basically that, a job board, a privacy focused job board. Like you have your Indeed, one that would, you know, use pseudonyms and, you know, have Bitcoin privacy by default and those sorts of things. It's a defunct project now. We don't have time for it, but, yeah, it's definitely important thing. And it's really the first step. It's really, really kind of that first step is either, you know, intensively save and, you know, put yourself in a position savings wise that you don't have to work, find location independent employment. And, again, it seems like that's kind of naturally just happening, in a lot of ways. So that's good. People kind of got that forced decompression time last year. A lot of folks did, but, Yeah, it's the first step. It's definitely the first step.
Yeah, but either it can be a large pile of savings, right? But, you know, even if you're unproductive and just accumulate or consume these savings, well, eventually they're going to run dry, right? So that's something to consider. So yeah, getting that true type of digital income is for sure, or probably a must, right? But the other side to financial independence, not just on the income side, but on the expenditure side, right? If you spend less, well, your savings will last you longer. Right. And so how did you feel the cost aspect of this nomadic lifestyle compared to others?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the biggest portion of most people, you know, if we're talking about the servile society, the biggest portion of people's income usually goes to like a mortgage or to rent or something along those lines. So, if you move into, I guess, a situation, for example, Rayo, the first lifestyle he pursued was van nomadism, and Max, like you. He moved out into a van, into a camper mounted on his pickup truck. So obviously that biggest expense is gone. We did an entire series on van nomadism, I guess, a few years back on the Vonnie podcast. From a bunch of case studies, I mean, anywhere from like $500 to $1,000 a month, is what a lot of these people were living on. From my experience, I was just camping out of my vehicle. Tent camping out of my Mercury Grand Marquis. I found a place to camp that was like $7 a night north of Austin, beautiful place. And, like I said, the unfortunate part is I was dependent upon the Servile Society for everything. So I had to buy everything, but I mean, I didn't have much to spend. I didn't have much to spend anyway. So I was kind of, I had to spend what I could spend, and it wasn't much. So. Cutting expenses is definitely important. That step alone could be, I guess, that first step for a lot of people. If they just cut their expenses up to a certain amount, they might find that instead of working 40 hours a week, they can now only work 20. And if that's, you know, half your time, you're halfway there to a, you know, liberated lifestyle per se. So, hopefully I answered your question. Rambling off there again.
No, I do enjoy the ramblings quite a lot. And yeah, that's a nice thing, right? When just alone when cutting off a physical building, and especially when combining your modes of transport and your place of living together, right, into one entity, one truck basically to live out of, that does save costs quite a bit. But like the biggest downside, as you said, and I would very much agree with that, is that you do need to import a lot of things from the first realm, right? Food, diesel, and all types of things. You're constantly in need to trade with others. Where do you think are the downsides of this more specifically?
Yeah. Well, I mean, so the I guess the mortgage, you know, the physical location's gone. That's a good first step. The next biggest expense for most people is food. And if you move out into a van, or from like a mortgage into an apartment with less rent or something, you save more money. You're limited on space to do things, right? You're limited on space you have to produce, whatever it is that you want to produce. That's definitely kind of the biggest downside is, dealing with that smaller space and something we're trying to, I mentioned Paznia here. I mentioned, kind of the groundwork for this was just traveling van nomads. Well, that is kind of, that is one of the problems. So what's my vision, my overall vision for Paznia is more of kind of a second realm network. So we've got, this homestead here, at Veritas Paznia is what I'm calling it. And, there's one out east. There's, freedomcells.org, which has a lot of, there's a lot of isolated people, that need to be connected. But really the idea would be to have these self-sufficient homesteads, of like-minded people within the second realm network that have been vetted. And, basically you get into this network and you can camp at any of these places. You don't have to rely upon the first realm for food because, like, for example, if, mine's a model for other homesteads, you'd have lamb, you'd have ducks, you'd have turkey, you'd have chicken. You'd have all of these things and this year we're starting a big garden too. So that's the other thing. That's kind of the idea is one, like, so there's kind of the notion of having your cake and eating it too. Well, I'm trying to make that possible. Trying to make it possible where you can have where this network gets built up and you could live a totally nomadic lifestyle and still not be reliant upon the first realm where we have, our own infrastructure, our own economy, all of those things. So, yes, to your point, that is the biggest thing with nomadic lifestyles is just the fact that you can't take as much stuff with you. You have less room to produce, in most situations. And the solution to that is, as I was saying, kind of this second realm network, that I'm kind of, well, just kind of, I'm trying to, I guess, put together here in the USSA, but certainly, I'm guessing it's probably already in motion, elsewhere overseas. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see. And this aspect of secure citadels, right? Secure temporal autonomous zones and a private and secure way of traveling in between them. I agree. I think this is really kind of the golden ticket where you can have the cake and eat it too.
Yep. And then, and on that property, and here again, if you have your cake and eat it too, we'll add another little layer to this. One of the biggest areas of coercion is, the legal interstices with the state where, especially like with proper, so-called property ownership, where you've got a title, they expect you to pay property taxes every year and those sorts of things. Like that opens up an individual to inevitable coercion. Like that's at least a couple times a year where you have to interface with the state. On not a very fun and friendly level, right? So, talking about the second realm here, the proxy merchant strategy, wherein the property that you have these homesteads on isn't in the name of the person that actually lives there. It's in the name of somebody who is an upstanding person, upstanding citizen of the first realm, that would never draw suspicion from anyone. Then you've got an added layer of protection there. And then, as I said, you just incorporate these security culture principles, these Vonnegut principles that Rayo, utilized back in the 1960s. And if any of your, any folks in the audience are interested in checking that out, I would recommend just going to vonnegutpodcast.com, free books tab, and you can learn about Rayo's lifestyle and get a pretty good taste, from either Vonnegut Book 1 or Vonnegut Book 2. But, really just incorporating these principles, and doing it in such a manner so that we can have this permanent place, right? We can have this permanent place that can also be, relatively invulnerable to coercions. So that's kind of the ideas. And you aren't supposed to be able to do that, right? Have your cake and eat it too. Well, we're going to try it and see how it works out.
Yeah, I mean, right, that's the whole point of liberty, is to try to experiment, right, and to recklessly reach out into new areas that were deemed impossible before, and just to see if it actually works out, mm-hmm. and maybe works out in a great extent. So you've mentioned now a couple of times, like, the concept of harassment, and this is, I think, one of the great contributions of Rayo in the terms of Wanuu, like that definition of mean time to harassment. Now, what is that actually, and why is it a meaningful metric to look at?
Mm-hmm. So the mean time to harassment was, so really one of the problems, I guess, that Rayo also foresaw is that there's a lot of strategies where it's impossible, where it's nearly impossible to gauge the efficacy of a strategy. So like political crusading, for example, like we know it doesn't work, but like if you actually try to put it out statistically, like it's very, very hard to actually quantify the success rate of someone running for office. Or for a lot of strategies, it's hard to quantify those things. So Rayo actually came up with this concept of mean time to harassment. And basically it's a way to gauge the efficacy of a Wanuu lifestyle. So, for example, it would measure the amount of time between, instances of coercion. So for example, a van nomad might have more interactions, or have a lower mean time to harassment than, someone who, practiced wilderness fauna in the middle of the woods. They would have more interactions with the servile society. They have more interactions with coercers in general. So that's the idea, is it's just a way to gauge the efficacy of a Wanuu lifestyle. And it's in terms of how often, you interact with the state or with private coercers is the idea.
Yeah, right. And I like that aspect too, that it's not just the state who's of course a big attacker, but private individuals are assholes as well, right? So, mm-hmm. just, you know, getting beaten over by thugs or your purse stolen, is, you know, harassment already. And, just by including this statistic, as well as any interaction with the state, right? Like requiring a license plate or paying property taxes or all these things that are not based on a voluntary ethical action. Can be nicely quantified, and then, as you said, right, compared across strategies, and we can kind of get a success metric out of this.
Right, and I'll also mention one other element that he puts in Wanuu Book 1, again, wanuupodcast.com, just go to that free books tab if you want to pull up this chart. It's in Wanuu Book 1, The Search for Personal Freedom. But there's a chart in there, too, and the other element that he puts on there is activity. So if you are a pedestrian, you know, traveling through the wilderness where there's nobody out there, the activity is going to be very, very low. Whereas if you are starting, you know, like small manufacturing facility, the activity is going to be a lot higher. So that's another element too, is, another element to mean time to harassment is also gauging, you know, like your own efficacy and possibilities, with your skills. So someone who is not very proficient at, security culture principles are not very proficient at, practicing the grand man or something along those lines. They might not be the best person to like start an intentional community or something like that, right? They might be best, getting a van and going and learning these things and trying it out and, you know, a more safer route, I guess you could say, one that would draw less attention, where they can, you know, kind of blend in and just kind of, learn these things in a safe, conducive environment. So yeah, that's another element too, when we're talking about Wanuu lifestyle changes is, the activity or the proficiency that one would need to have. And again, to go back to this example, starting intentional community, which involves, you know, dispute resolution and all sorts of complex stuff versus driving a car around, which we're taught to do when we're 16, you know, by the state. So if the state can teach us to drive, via their dumb DMVs and shit, then it's probably a pretty easy thing to do, right? So, yes, we're talking about proficiency levels here as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the activity of what you do is very important here, right? And there is a scale, right? You could just be, you know, alone in the wilderness hunting and foraging berries or whatnot, right? But that's a very different thing than running a small manufacturer to produce, I don't know, the tables or some carpentry. And that's again very different to running a multinational global corporation, interacting with hundreds of customers and employees. And there will be different attackers for each of these, and different threat vectors and threat models that have to be considered.
Yeah, for sure. That's very, very well said. Very well said. I don't think I have anything to add, but that's a very good way to put it. Yeah.
And I think here the concept of privacy really ties in nicely. Where do you see, or how would you define privacy, and how does it fit in here?
Sure, sure. So privacy, I guess, to me is my right to self-ownership, exposed when I want it to be, it's core to my self-ownership, but really the idea is to expose myself when I want to expose myself, right? And not mean that in a way that I think it is, but I expose myself to the world in the way, like when I want to expose myself to the world in a way that I want to. Having that choice, is really privacy. And so,
yeah, maybe to paraphrase that, right? It's about selectively revealing yourself to the world, right?
And right. Yep.
It's much easier to, like, you get away with not at all revealing yourself to the world if you are in the forest alone, you know, hunting a deer. Mm-hmm. Right? That's a very limited type of exposure, and very little individuals will actually see you and attribute the actions to your person, right? Well, compared to if you were running this large business with thousands of clients and employees, well, you know, necessarily you will have to reveal yourself to a greater extent so to get the job done. And right. Then how does that aspect of when you actually reveal yourself come into the security aspect in terms of the OODA loop?
Yeah, so in terms of volume more generally, you mean?
Yes, exactly.
Really it comes down to with Vanu, obviously the lifestyle change would make a difference. If you're Vanuing in city, if you're Vanuing pursuing Vanu in a city, you're going to have a lot more exposure, potential exposure, as you're saying, someone who's pursuing wilderness Vanu out in the middle of the woods. So as far as when that revealing happens, well, there's another important Vanu principle that Rayo came up with called import export. The idea is to, import goods and knowledge from the servile society back to your Vanu home base. And then you export your labor back to, the servile society. So, this is, making up for the fact that, back in the 1960s, they didn't have, the online freelance entrepreneurship sort of angle. So back in the 1960s, you had to basically go back to the city to work. You'd work a really intensive, you'd work really intensive job for 3 months, intensively save, and then go live in the woods for 6 months was kind of his strategy. So, how does the OODA loop selectively exposing oneself in terms of Vanu? Well, it would come down to import export. How often you choose to interface with the servile society. If you live a more nomadic lifestyle and you have many supply caches on private property scattered throughout, and you don't have to have very much interaction with the servile society, then you wouldn't have to reveal your privacy that often, to the servile society, to potential coercers. So yeah, it would come down to just dependent upon what lifestyle change you choose. Obviously, more people, more chance of coercion, generally speaking, and then also import export. So how often you need to interface with the servile society would be how often you might have to. Inadvertently reveal your privacy in some manner.
Yes, exactly. And so, of course, most optimal would be if there would be no revelation to the first realm whatsoever, right? So if you could fully stay within that second realm, mm-hmm. In a Vanu principled, or ethical enclave. But this will be difficult, right? Because division of labor is nice, and there are many monkeys in the first realm who can do things for you. And so somehow interacting with them while still protecting your privacy and not necessarily revealing that you are the one engaging in that activity is a very interesting privacy strategy. So what are some of the steps to do this more efficiently? I mean, you mentioned first realm proxy merchants already, but are there some other strategies?
In terms of Vanu, I guess another element of this the proxy merchant strategy is really for more of the permanent autonomous zones. That's kind of the route to go. It's just dependent upon the lifestyle change for folks. A lot of folks are stuck in cities for one reason or another. Maybe employment, maybe work, maybe whatever. In terms of privacy in the cities. I would just point your listeners, to in the direction of, strategies like the gray man blending in. And then, Kyle Reardon, posts on my coast, Old Coast, I guess, on the Bonnie podcast now. Hopefully, he'll be back at some point. But he wrote a book called Just Below the Surface, A Guide to Security Culture. And, obviously it goes into kind of the low tech and the high, some of the high tech sort of privacy stuff. But then also, it goes into, I guess, maybe an underlooked at aspect, of this is that, he looked at some activist organizations as case studies that have just been terrible on privacy. The leaders have been infiltrators, and they reveal the entire, membership list and, intake information to, the feds or something. So that's another element too, is just, just be careful about who you interact with. Practice good vetting. Here at Pasnia, we've got a strict principle that, you have to forswear the use of coercion, if you're going to come on the property. So, those would just be a couple of things, in terms of some of the nomadic lifestyles. It can be difficult, especially for, and again, I don't have personal experience with this, so everything that I find out is just on the internet and from folks who have reported on it when I was on Fascistbook and they would, posting groups and such. But, like if you're living on a sailboat, for example, I have heard, I've gotten verification from a number of occasions that, like, if you're going to go into a port, like at a city, if you're going to go conduct import export on a boat, like, not only do you have to check in with like one government agency, but usually it's like five different bureaucracies that you have to check in with, like living on a sailboat. So as far as it can get, it's very, very nuanced. And a lot of that nuance comes from, experience of doing it over and over again. So, I'll mention living on a sailboat as that one kind of complication. But like I said, just be careful about who you're working with. Make sure they're vetted. And, I think that's another important thing, because it's not always the state. Like, the state usually doesn't do a very good, like, as far as investigative work, they don't usually do any of that, right? Like, it's usually just people snitching or open source intelligence. They just, look on Fascistbook or something. So, if you cut out, if you're careful about that, I think that's a very, very good thing.
And there's probably one point of conflict here that, free individuals are usually private individuals, right? And they very carefully choose what to reveal about themselves to others. But on the other hand, right, as you said, we kind of need to get that reputation and that vetting of the history of another person to ensure that they actually do live by voluntarist principles. So how do you kind of manage that conflict of working with anonymous people while still gathering reputation from them?
Yeah, it's definitely tough, but at least it's tough, and it's in its early stages right now. I said for Pasnia, for this physical one, I do know there's given names and pseudonyms for these individuals, but really it was a spontaneous thing. Again, I did not plan any of this. It just so happened that for the past 5 years, I've been vetting these people. And they're all, the best people. I want them out here, and that's why that they're coming out here. But if you're in a position to plan something like that, like go to 5 years of freedom festivals, which, and build up, reputation that way, like that's a really good way, or just, other temporary autonomous zones with, freedom minded individuals, over a course of a number of years, you can pretty much tell, I would say beyond that, I think it's just experimenting with reputation systems, physical space and time. It's tough because at least as of this point, I don't know these folks by pseudonyms. So, I know I'm at a deeper level than that. So, it's a little tough there. I guess that's what I can offer. That's what I can offer at this point.
Yeah, for sure, right? The more you engage with both anonymous identities, the more they do reveal themselves and the more reputation you can gather up, right? But mm-hmm. it's also a question of scale, right? Because sure, at small scale, you can probably do a very thorough vetting process and really consider in depth if you want to work with one person or not. But of course, there's a huge cost to it, right? And a lot of, well, hassle and uncertainty that will probably fail to scale to any meaningful gathering of more than a couple hundred people.
Yeah, yeah. And for a lot of people, finding that first person to vet is hard enough. You know, finding that first person that they're going to, you know, the vet for a local, you know, to start an intentional community or something, that's going to be hard to find for some folks even. So yeah, having that time, having that time is great. But beyond that, I mean, it's experimenting with reputation systems. You know, Smuggler and XYZ and Second Book on Strategy talked about, anonymous trading booths and things. Here right now, like I said, like it's all very, very personal. Like we're trying to build an intentional community here. So we all know each other very well. But we also want to, you know, open that outwards. Start looking at some of these things too, because, we want to be able to trade with as many people as safely as possible, right? Like we want to open up trade, you know, this pocket of freedom to as many people as we can. We have to do it in a safe manner. And if there's a way where we can trade, not even have like, just additional ways, like that. I think those are worth looking into. But yeah, all those are theoretical right now for me. At least a lot of them. Really just the tried and true method of vetting, whether it's, in person or online, whether you know them or someone that you both know and trust can verify, like that's still, I think, kind of the best way to go. I don't see a way around that. I don't know if I want to go around that more personable route, personally.
Yes, and I wonder how much technology can actually help us to kind of scale that interaction, specifically because we can use, you know, advanced cryptography and, you know, incentive structures so that we can collaborate with others without necessarily relying trust or security into their hands. Right. So, for example, the Wasabi CoinJoin Coordinator is a perfect example for this, as it is a centralized service, right? But that central service has no information about its customers whatsoever. And therefore, attacks and harassments by that service provider, or even someone attacking the service provider, become no longer feasible, right? Because there is literally nothing to steal. And because of that, like specifically the Wasabi coordinator can in fact talk and do business with a plethora of anonymous people without any reputation whatsoever, just because that the underlying protocol is secure enough.
Sure. Yeah. I'm sure technology can play a role. I mean, the last time we talked, Max, we referred back to Rayo's, theoretical vision of what I guess turned out to be, BISC in some ways. But, trying to find ways using technology to do these things. Especially in the realm of Bitcoin and encrypted communications, there's certainly a lot of, I think, a lot of promise there. Definitely, for sure. For reputation, still like the personable routes, which doesn't always work and scale for digital, which I understand.
Yes. Now, one other interesting way to get at least a level of reputation is with financial skin in the game. And I know that you're experimenting with some type of like financial shared Bitcoin accounts that can be used in like for emergency expenses. Could you elaborate a bit more on how that actually works for you?
Yes. That's another great method of a great vetting method, which is not an ironclad one, but you can weed out a number of folks that way. You can find the most committed ones at least. For Paznia, we've got a stakeholder thing, which people can, I guess, it's kind of like the membership thing for the intentional community. But beyond that, we have the a fellow Paznian who came up with this idea. We call it the establishment of the Paznia General Bitcoin Fund. And you'll note for people, if you look at paznia.com, most of this is culture jamming. So like it's supposed to be a joke, supposed to be funny. This is the Paznia General Bitcoin Fund. And, the person that set it up. And I guess this is a good, one interesting way for reputation is that, you know, he goes by a pseudonym, Josiah Warren. Josiah Warren was a potential community guy back a while ago, I think in the late 1800s for those who are interested. But, to some of the folks, that have, you know, seen this fund and all that, he's just a synonymous individual, but, he's verified and all that. But yeah, the idea is, he set up this fund. They've got to be a PAS, they've got to be a stakeholder PASNIA. He laid out some stipulations, but yeah, the idea is, if there's, for a legal defense fund for homestead upgrades for, he even put in if someone wants, publishing assistant or needs, help with publishing, that's in there too. But yeah, the idea is he made an initial donation into this Bitcoin fund. Some other folks made donations. And so I think, as of the last that I heard as of a couple weeks ago, a portion of that fund's going to be, allocated towards, the PASNIA out, that PASNIA out east. So there's going to be some homestead upgrades happening, to the overarching PASNIA network. So, that's a little bit on the PASNIA General Bitcoin Fund. Yeah, just a way to crowdfund some second realm activity.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting. And I remember from the book Hashtag Agora, which I believe you also have published, there is the scene where the two characters are traveling with some contraband, some laptops, high security devices that they plan to sell. And ultimately they get snitched up by the cops and let into some interrogation camp. While then because they were in such a second realm, well, gathering and specifically part of such a security fund, right? Their comrades, basically outside, not yet under attack, then issued, or got a lawyer to actually get them out of the situation, right? And in this way, even though you're under attack, because you know that there is some amount of Bitcoin stashed outside for specifically those purposes, to get you out of the tough situation. Mm-hmm. I think this is a very big decrease of uncertainty, and at least the hindrance of the level of harassment that it can be happening.
Yeah, for sure. And I talked to Sal Mayweather from the Agora podcast a couple few weeks ago, and one thing that's I think it was Derek Rose, another guest, brought up was kind of like an Agora's defense fund, like some sort of like worldwide cooperative sort of thing. I think all those things are fantastic. They need to be pursued. I mean, it's another, regardless of, when it comes to the second realm, regardless of what area of the human experience we're talking about, like all of that needs to be internalized, in the second realm. Because if it exists in the first realm, it exists in the realm of coercion, at the very least, and often at the violation of privacy too. So, this is just another one of those things, if you want to call it charity or, whatever it is, I mean, this is an element. This is an element of it, and I'm happy. It's shout out to Josiah Warren for coming up with this and for funding the fund initially. For sure.
Yeah, very useful endeavor, absolutely. As you mentioned previously, Rayo also spoke a lot about encrypted communications. So maybe can you elaborate a bit on why this is so important in the Vanu strategy?
Yeah. So, I say a lot that, if the coercers can't find you, they can't coerce you. Well, if the coercers can't read what you write, then they can't use, they can't use your words against you. If all it is just, illegible, ciphertext, then they can't really get a whole lot out of that. Encryption, encrypted communication certainly plays a role in the Vanu sphere. A further iteration, I would say, we've got, Rayo talked about kind of the encrypted ham radio networks. There's, obviously the low tech, ciphers, using, pen and paper. A newer kind of iteration that I'll toss in that's Kyle Reardon actually wrote an article on. It's, in his book, just below the surface, he got a security culture, but that's called dual layer encryption. And, the idea is that, digital encryption is great, but why not add an extra layer of security to it? So, the idea is to come up with a handwritten cipher, and you would put that into PGP. You'd write the message, you'd encrypt it with the handwritten cipher, whatever you guys agree, whatever you and the recipient agree upon. You would put that into, say, PGP or whatever encryption software you're using. It would encrypt it there. Then they would decrypt it on their ends digitally. Then they would decrypt it manually on the other end. So, yeah, I mean, all this stuff plays into it. If you look if you look into Rayo's writings, he was, you know, I mean, back in the 1960s, there are some things like, I mean, he went about as far as you could in the realm of, in this realm of, you know, privacy and security culture. So, it plays a major role, again, if the coercers can't find you, they can't coerce you. And if they can't read what you write, then they can't use your words against you. So,
Yes, that really is an important part, right? And especially when it comes to trade. And I mean, sure, some chit chat and small talk wouldn't even be that bad if the coercers would find that. But if we're actually talking about business dealings and contracts, then yes, encrypting communications is even more important, and as there's actual physical property on the line.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, so one of the other things that you also mentioned a bit previously was basically stashing, right? And having physical locations where some equipment or food is stored. Can you please go a bit more into the details of why this is important and how to actually set it up?
Sure. So the idea is, as we talked about a little bit ago with nomadic lifestyles, the idea, one of the problems is storage or self-sufficiency, right? Like if you always have to go to the survival society for food, then, you're not very, independent from it. So, Rayo, in the 1960s and 70s, he had supply caches, all over, I think, in British Columbia region, Northern California, Southern Oregon, the Siskiyou region, with food, camping supplies, whatever he may have needed out there, in the wilderness. So, the idea is, in that sort of sense, more of an individual sort of sense, to bury supply caches with things you might need, in that area if ever need be. And, you'd have access to them. It increases your storage space. At least it's another way of having your cake and eating it too. And, I guess the newest iteration of that, and what we're as I've been talking about, what we're trying to do with Pasnia is make it where these supply caches aren't just empty 55 gallon drums, but they're actually like a community with a culture and with all sorts of stuff. So that's just the idea. It's a way to increase the storage and self sufficiency capabilities despite living a nomadic lifestyle and not having a 22 acre homestead, not having a house with a basement and a storage room, or things like that. These are ways of adapting to, ways of adapting to, smaller living spaces and just different situations in general.
Yes. And in addition to that, I found it always very interesting when Sreyo said that it's also a kind of nice diversion tactic. So that, for example, if you have a campsite somewhere where there are not many goods laying around, there's not much food, there's not many tools, there's not much wood supply or whatnot, right? If it's just a bare bone, living quarter, then this looks much less suspicious, right? Compared to if, there's a year's worth of food supply and such on stashed in the campsite directly, that will draw a lot of attention if someone actually passes by. So that idea that even though if you would have a physical location, to store some of your wealth, hidden and dispersed away from your actual main living place, makes your main living place also less attractive for looters, which is a great privacy and security strategy again.
For sure. Yeah, and redundancy, especially we're talking digital digital realm now, or Bitcoin private keys. Don't only keep that at, one Vanu home base, make sure those are, all spread all over the place and that you always have a way to access them. They're great tools. Certainly great tools. And, I guess I will mention just, since we're on this realm, I came across a book by, Limpanks Unlimited, called, it's the big book of secret hiding places. And, the author, Jack Luger, goes into some of that stuff. It's available for free online. As all our stuff is, as everything I put out is, but, if you're interested in learning more about the hiding stuff, I found that to be a very, very valuable book, to read and to digitize. So, I mean, I'll toss that one out there. And then also we talked about the Vonnie podcast. If people just go to VonniePodcast.com/episodes, it's all laid out by seasons. Season one is the philosophy of Vonnie. Season two is the practice of Vonnie. In season two, we talk about food storage in one episode. And I think there's probably another episode or two that talks about you know, similar and related subjects that I'm not thinking about off the top of my head. Yeah, great tools for sure.
Yes. So I think we did cover quite a decent amount of ground in the Vonnie philosophy. Is there any major point that we have not yet talked about?
Not really. I guess I should have, which hopefully folks have gone and checked it out by now if they're interested. But Vonnie is an awkward contraction of the words voluntary and not vulnerable. Just premise around becoming as invulnerable to the coercion of the state and the servile society as humanly possible. That's what all of the Vonnie lifestyle changes are geared towards. That's why I found the second realm strategy so important. That's why I find Bitcoin privacy just so critically important. These are all very, very interconnected strategies. I certainly do hope that your audience finds value in it, checks it out, and lets me know if they're living a liberated lifestyle. Always love to hear about it. So, yeah.
Yes, very nice. Right, that aspect. Like, I appreciate Vonnie not just because I think it's actually a sound strategy for a freer lifestyle, but also because it has that ethical emphasis at the foreground. Right, it has to be a voluntary interaction; otherwise, it's not even in the realm of Vonnie whatsoever. And so it completely makes it impossible for one who actually lives by the strategy to become aggressive and to become that coercer. And as you said, right, anyone who comes to Pasnia and actually steps on your property will have to swear that he does not aggress against others.
Yeah, well, and in a sense, yes. Everyone here, like we do have, if again, it's the free republic of Pasnia, if we do have a Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. The initial stakeholders, I think all of them have probably, actually signed, maybe with a pseudonym, which is what we encourage here. We always encourage pseudonyms here. But a lot of them have explicitly signed the Constitution. But yes, it's critical. It's a critical foundational point. You know, there are a lot of people in my personal life who I know they're good people, I don't really want to trade with them. I don't really want to interact with them a whole lot because they still they haven't exercised that spook of coercion. They haven't exercised that. So I hope they do, and we want to open up Pasnia to as many people as possible. But unfortunately this is the way we have to do it. But same time, it's still a lot of fun. And I've tried to emphasize this in the past couple interviews I've done, but freedom is definitely possible, and especially people who have been listening to Max know that. So it's definitely possible. And with that, yeah, Max, thanks for inviting me on. It was a great chat, and appreciate it.
Yeah, Vonnie is yours for the making. To steal your catchphrase, but it's yep. Very adequate one. Right? It really is possible to live a free life and a peaceful life. And not just to just survive meagerly in such a place, but actually excel. I think both you and I can speak for that of how refreshing it is to have these priorities as the foundational building block for how to structure your own life. It's very rewarding and something that I for sure can very much recommend to further pursue and to go down, even though that it might look scary and unintuitive at first.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yep, that's, yes, it, exactly.
And now, again, to quote one more time the book, The Agora, or hashtag Agora, one important phrase that probably all agorists should be interested in, just to now finish this up. Shane, what are you actually selling?
What am I actually selling? I have a Liberty published, Liberty focused publishing outfit called Liberty Attack Publications. LibertyAttack.com. We have right now we've got a lot of books, strategy guides, a lot of books on Vonnie that I've digitized and put out in paperback format for those who don't like to read things off computer screens or digital screens in general. We've also sold some crypto anarchy tools. We sold a Vonnie pad, a Vonnie ghost pad with all sorts of cool hacking accessories. We've only sold one of those so far, and hoping to get a lot more of those sorts of tools back on there. So it's not just books. We are going to try to offer some really, really, Yeah, some really, really valuable crypto anarchy tools there in the near future. And if any of your audience is writing a book and they need help with the publishing process, so we help with that too. Libertarianattack.com is to go for all that. And as I've been talking about, Vanu podcast, I sell freedom strategies essentially is what I do. That's my job now, I guess I could say. Vanu podcast for that. You can find us on all the major podcatchers. Library and Odyssey as well. Got everything backed up there. And otherwise, Paznia.com. If you're interested, if you're in the USSA, and you'd like to come visit the Free Republic, Paznia.com is the place to go to learn more. We've got various Telegram chats. You can find links to those on the website, and more information about Vanu Fest. Vanu Fest 2 is happening at the end of the year. Otherwise, I guess that's it.
When are the silver coins and gold coins are actually going to be issued?
That's a good question. So it was a lack of foresight on my part. A bad time to try to get custom coins printed. A really, really bad time to do so. That was going to happen last year. It's probably not going to happen for at least a couple of years. The few companies I found that were still doing their custom minting, they had a way too high of limit. We don't have we don't have a treasury here at Paznia. We don't have taxation or anything. We can't afford that sort of thing yet. So we'll have to wait until we have the funds for that. But
hopefully soon, 3D printers who can do gold and silver. That will be great.
Yes, and the other problem too is you have to get regardless of how many you print, whether you print 5 or 5,000, you have to print. I guess it's the I don't know what you would even call it. I guess the stencil for it. It's hundreds of dollars just for the stencil. And if we're gonna do 6 varieties, you gotta have 6 different stencils. And I think there's a lot to it. I looked in the entire process. The 3D printer was an interesting one as well. Because we did have one of those on the property from Vanu Fest 1 for a little while. It's just too complicated this time. Gold, silver, little out of our reach.
Well, then maybe you can do some digital coins. Maybe you can get some color coins on Bitcoin. Or just a bunch of open dimes with a Paznia theme. That will be interesting too. Well, yeah, Shane, thanks so much for coming on the show. We really was a pleasure to talk with you about all things Vanu, agorism, and just living a freer lifestyle in the here and now. Very fascinating rabbit holes. And again, for all the listeners, check out all the great work that Shane has released. Really a plethora of knowledge and in a great archive. So thanks a lot for coming on.
Hey, thank you, Max. I appreciate it.